Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Patty Bragland. I'm here on behalf of the claimant. My registration number is 22664. We are here on two basic issues. The first is one that has been appealed by respondents, which is essentially an offset for military benefits. I think that issue is extremely straightforward. It's been previously determined that individuals of the armed forces do not fit the definition of employee, and therefore, as a result, there cannot be an offset for those benefits. I think the City and County of Denver and Colorado Compensation Insurance Authority, when it was analyzing the subsequent injury fund and the admission of an individual into the subsequent injury fund, clearly identified that they simply are not employees, and therefore they cannot be employers, and therefore there cannot be an employer offset for benefits that were received from the military.
Ms. Ragland, there is an offset permitted against Social Security.
For Social Security
Administration,
Your Honor,
parents.
I was starting with military benefits.
And what is the difference, other than your not an employee argument? What's the difference between? Let me back up. I want to make sure I ask this the correct way. As I understand it, Mr. Zerba received both military disability benefits and military retirement benefits.
Correct.
What's the difference between the military retirement and the Social Security retirement?
Your Honor, I think that there has been a federal and state determination that we are simply going to consider them to be different, because when an individual is in service to this country through the military, they simply are not performing the same type of duties. The obligations of those individuals are not the same, and they are simply analyzed as being individuals who are not employees of the military.
But a distinction between a retirement benefit and a military disability benefit. Are you treating them both as the same, or can you address military disability?
If an individual is receiving any benefit from the military, they have not been an employee of the military. And if they are not an employee of the benefit of the military, then there can be no employee-employer relationship, and therefore cannot be an employer-type offset, whether it be for disability or whether it be employer-type offsets as it relates to retirement or disability, because they simply don't fit the criteria.
I don't mean to argue. My concern and the difficulty I have is that, particularly in the era of the volunteer army, we have an individual who retires from the military, and then he works long enough as an employee to get Social Security benefits. Not only that, but when he's in the army, he gets a GS rating. He is very much an employee. He's an employee of Uncle Sam, and he gets pay grade increases the longer he stays in. So I guess what I'm wrestling with is I'm having a very difficult time distinguishing between military retirement and Social Security retirement solely on the basis that he's quote not an employee of one, but he is an employee of the other.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, is there a question?
Well, we don't have a case, do we, in Colorado that specifically says that when it comes to military retirement benefits, there is no offset permitted for industrial claims?
Your Honor, I believe that the City and County of Denver and the Colorado Compensation Insurance Authority versus ICAO at 892 P. 2nd 429 addresses so specifically the issue of the distinction between an employer and an employee relationship and the VA benefits that the offset issue is not necessarily required to be reached in any case, because this case is so on point with respect to the relationships that are created through the VA benefits. If we had a structure, and I'm sure Your Honor is familiar with the subsequent injury fund that was created years ago and now no longer accepts individuals into that fund because it was closed, but there was a significant analysis that went on with respect to whether individuals with disabilities from the military could be accepted into the subsequent injury fund. And it was concluded that they could not be because, in fact, the subsequent injury fund took only those individuals into the fund that had a prior work-related injury, and it was specifically determined that individuals with military injuries could not be taken into that fund because they did not constitute work-related injuries because it was a military scenario from which the disability arose. With respect to the other issue that we're here for, which is the Social Security disability offset, which is the issue that claimant raised on appeal, I think that there is a significant issue here and something that needs to be analyzed with respect to the distinction that the courts made between the coordination of benefits, which is permitted under the Culver decision, and the complete elimination of benefits, which was the discussion based on the age-based elimination of benefits that came and I apologize, I just lost the case name, from the Romero decision that had been done. The Supreme Court went through a significant analysis in Culver and in Romero, and candidly, even in the Avalanche decision, when the average weekly wage issue is discussed by the Supreme Court and the import of the average weekly wage issue that strings through workers' compensation benefits completely, across the board, and the need, frankly, of an analysis by an administrative law judge of how average weekly wage is conducted plays directly into the analysis of the Culver decision as well as the analysis that comes from the Romero decision. We have individuals who, as they, and specifically Mr. Zerba, we have benefits that he is receiving from Social Security, and between the ages of 62 and 70, when an individual receives money from their part-time employment that exceeds the amount of benefits that Social Security allows for that year, for every $2 earned, a dollar has to be paid back to Social Security by that individual. That analysis is reviewed and considered in the Culver case specifically. What we have now is an individual who, because he falls in that age category, is discriminated against based upon, in part, his age, but also in the manner in which the administrative law judge applied the Culver decision. We have a situation where Mr. Zerba is essentially double taxed or hit doubly for the offset because of the manner in which this is done. The Culver case that was decided by the Supreme Court said that it's okay to have a statute that considers this coordination of benefits, but the Romero case was decided and it said, but you can't have this arbitrary age-based elimination of benefits. And that's how this decision that was made by the administrative law judge comes down, because of the facts of this case and because of the ages that's considered in this case. And that's what's in error, and that's what needs to be sent back to the administrative law judge for more appropriate findings. The specifics as to how the average weekly wage affects this particular case, I would ask for Your Honors to look at the folio site, specifically at pages 1175 and 1176. I would also ask that Your Honors consider the specific language in the position statement on these issues as well, that is found at the folio site of specifically pages beginning at 1108. I think you get a very in-depth analysis in those pages specifically of how the average weekly wage can be used in a circumstance to allow this statute and to allow the offset to remain constitutional if the administrative law judge properly utilizes the discretion that's granted in calculating average weekly wage during the analysis that is done in this particular case and as it applies to all individuals that are between the ages of 62 and 70 as described by the Culver analysis. And I would like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may.
Good afternoon. And again, I apologize for walking in late. May it please the court, my name is Margaret Keck and my attorney registration number is 9794. I'd like to make a few brief points, and I'll tell you what those are before I go into them. One is that this is a facial challenge, or at least Mr. Zerba is mounting a facial challenge to the constitutionality of 842.103.1 sub C sub Roman numeral 2, and that he's required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that law is unconstitutional. And secondly, the Colorado Supreme Court case of Culver versus Ace Electric Controls, both the issue of whether Mr. Zerba's Social Security retirement benefits may be offset against his permanent total disability benefits, and also whether his military retirement benefits may be offset in part against his permanent total disability benefits. The third point I want to make is that the prohibition against stacking retirement and permanent total disability benefits or the encouragement of coordinating those benefits, it's not only what the General Assembly intended, it makes sense for a lot of reasons. And then finally, if I have time, I'd like to discuss the issue of average weekly wage, which was raised in Council's answer brief, and I hadn't had a chance to discuss it in much detail. I think the Colorado case of, or the Colorado Supreme Court case of Culver v. Ace Electric totally controls, it's directly on point whether or not the military retirement benefits may be offset. And that statute is 842.103 sub 1 sub C sub Roman numeral 2. The very next section of the statute, 842.103 sub 1 sub C sub Roman numeral 2.5, talks about not just the Social Security retirement, but all other kinds of retirement. I think it's clear from the way the statute is written that the General Assembly intended to offset all retirement benefits that are in one manner or another paid for by employers as distinguished paid for by employees when those employees become injured and become entitled to permanent total disability benefits. There's just simply no principal distinction between the Social Security retirement benefits and the military retirement benefits that Mr. Zerba was receiving. They both fall under the rubric of this statute, and there's really no basis for making that distinction.
Because I understand, Ms. Ragland, he's in the case of military service, he's not an employee, and I guess it naturally follows logically that the government's not an employer.
Well, I don't think the fact whether he's an employee or an employer is really the deciding factor. In the city and county of Denver, the issue there was whether the subsequent injury fund had to contribute to permanent total disability benefits, because the statute that was under discussion in that case said the subsequent injury fund contributes when there's been a prior industrial disability. So then the court had to go and review what was meant by industrial disability if someone had been injured while in the military. And what the court found was is that if you're in the military and you get hurt just by virtue of being in the military, serving in the military, you get veterans disability benefits. Now, that injury does not have to occur while you're performing military duties. It could be when you're at home on leave, falling down the stairs. It could be in an auto accident that has nothing to do with the military service. What they found was is that what the military offered was a disability policy that wasn't necessarily industrially related. These people in the military get disability benefits regardless of whether it occurs in the service of their military duties or not. Just the fact that they're in the military is why they get those benefits. So the court decided in the city and county of Denver that because those benefits in the military could be awarded for non-industrial injuries as well as industrial injuries, that the subsequent injury fund wasn't liable. And that's what the real distinction is. It's not this distinction between employer and not employee, not employee. It's whether or not while you're in the military, you can get disability benefits for anything that befalls you, regardless of whether you're serving military duty at the time the accident befalls you.
So then how does this employer-employee terminology in the statute apply? You're saying the Denver case is, in effect, inapposite from the statute. So would you address the employer-employee issue then?
In terms of which statute, I'm not clear on where the employer-employee argument even arises in the statute, because the statute simply says that there should be an offset for employer-paid retirement benefits. The military is the employer of Mr. Zerba and all other people in the military at the time that they were, at the time the employee is serving. That is the serviceman's job, is to serve in the military, and the military is their employer. They are employees.
Well, the American taxpayer
is
the employer.
Yes.
Is the nature of a military retirement benefit a wage replacement in the same sense that the Social Security retirement benefit is?
As best I know, Your Honor, I couldn't address that more specifically. It's simply you serve your time in the military X number of years. It's probably 20 years, and you're entitled to the military retirement. In Social Security, you have to reach a certain age and contribute into the system, and then you're entitled to Social Security retirement benefits.
Right, but if you're making too much money, you might not get a Social Security benefit, right?
No, I don't think so. I don't think Social Security is dependent upon your income.
If the older person is working and earning, isn't that why the claimant in this case only worked a part-time wage? Because if he worked a full-time wage, it would impact against the amount he could draw from Social Security?
Yes.
But the military retirement benefit doesn't work that way, right?
It's not in the record. I don't know, Your Honor.
Ms. Keck, is there any significance to the statement in the briefs that Mr. Zerba also had a disability retirement?
Well, the significance is that the administrative law judge and the industrial claims appeals panel relied on the Spanish Speaks mental health case. And that case turned on a disability retirement, not a regular retirement. And so that's why that is important. And it's been our contention all along that the Spanish Speaks mental health case simply doesn't apply. The way the General Assembly has chosen to treat the offset of retirement benefits is different than how they've chosen to apply the offset for disability benefits. Starting with, the offset for retirement benefits only applies to an award of permanent total disability benefits, whereas the offset for disability benefits applies to temporary total, temporary partial, used to be permanent partial until 2010, and also permanent total. And then there's a lot of other variations in treatment besides that.
So let me ask hypothetically, if someone were employed their entire life in Michigan and then received Social Security benefits upon retirement, age 62, whatever, then they move to Colorado and they have part-time work in Colorado, can you offset against the Social Security benefits that arise from Michigan employment?
Yes, because Social Security benefits are a federal benefit. They apply regardless of where you're working and where you earn them. It's just a federal, it's not an entitlement program. It's more like an insurance program that everyone pays into regardless of where your residence is in the United States. Okay. So the reason it makes sense to coordinate these benefits is that there's been some distinction made in the case law between retirement versus disability and how those two compensate for different things, but not really. He was receiving, as you've already acknowledged, he's received Social Security retirement, military retirement, also 401k retirement, and his VA disability benefits. The retirement benefits are meant to replace wages when an individual is no longer working because of age. And permanent total disability benefits are meant to replace wage loss sustained as a result of an inability to earn wages due to an injury. Yet in this case, Mr. Zerba's age played a large part in the award of the permanent total disability benefits. The judge talked in two different places in his order about the fact that Mr. Zerba's age was contributing to his decision to declare Mr. Zerba permanently totally disabled. He said that when the when my client tried to argue that age had no effect on his ability to obtain employment in the future, the judge responded saying the denial of the role of the claimant's age in obtaining employment is particularly unpersuasive. So what was happening is Mr. Zerber was being awarded permanent total disability benefits in part because of his age. And he had other non-worker health-related problems that also impacted his ability to get a job. He had osteoporosis, he had lumbar spine disease, and he had prostate problems that the judge said make it almost impossible for him to perform work that requires him to remain at a workstation. So the bottom line is that what we're seeing here is a coordination of benefits where he has retirement benefits, he has permanent total disability benefits. Those benefits are being coordinated so that he is not receiving permanent total disability benefits for what in effect is really more of a disability based upon age than the actual injury. I'm not denying that he had an injury, but a huge part of why he was declared permanently and totally disabled was because of his age, not because of the injury. So it makes sense to coordinate the benefits in the way that the General Assembly has seen fit, which is to allow reduction for part of the Social Security benefits and part of the military retirement benefits against his permanent total disability benefits. After all, the permanent total disability benefits in this case, they're supposed to compensate for a loss of ability to earn a living. He's close to the end of his working life. And most of the permanent total disability benefits that he would receive if it were not for the offset would be paid to him regardless of the fact that he wouldn't be working anyway because he's retired for age-related concerns. So the coordination of these programs actually does make a lot of sense, and it accomplishes all the goals that the Colorado Supreme Court addressed in the Culver versus Ace Electric case. With regard to average weekly wage, it's been argued that the average weekly wage should be revised to take this into consideration the offset for Social Security, but I need to insist that wasn't raised as an issue at the hearing. The first page of the record includes an application for hearing filed by counsel for the respondents. That application for hearing is a form promulgated by the Division of Workers' Compensation. It includes various issues with checkboxes. One of those issues that can be checked is average weekly wage, and it was not. And average weekly wage was not argued as a specific discrete issue at the hearing. And that's important because average weekly wage is defined by two statutes, and it is addressed by a lot of case law. And it needed to, if we're going to talk about increasing average weekly wage in order to account for the fact that Mr. Zerber is experiencing an offset for his retirement benefits, we need to look at what the statute says, whether the statute includes remuneration beyond work performed and includes either perhaps insurance benefits, such as Social Security, perhaps investment income. There are a lot of things that need to be considered in average weekly wage before we simply say, well, average weekly wage should have been revised. In other words, average weekly wage, if it was going to be revised to take into account these offsets, should have been made an issue for hearing, and it was not. It wasn't argued at hearing. The Industrial Claims Appellate Panel said it wasn't raised as at hearing, and they couldn't consider it. And as a result, it's our position that this court cannot consider the issue of average weekly wage at this time either. With that, if I have nothing more to offer at this time, unless you have some more questions for me.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Keck.
Your Honor, I think there are several points here that I would like to go back to, if I may, and specifically Section 842.103, which was 1C2.5, which is what was discussed by Respondents' Counsel in their argument. I think that there is a significant difference between 2.5 and 3. And if your honors will review the statute, you'll see that the legislature has seen fit to specifically identify as something that is entitled to offset the federal old age survivors and disability insurance amendments. The generalized category, which was referred to by Ms. Keck, is those areas where we have more of a generalized benefit for other disability benefits. And in fact, that is where the specific employer-employee relationship is identified because of the language that's contained within the statute, because it actually states that in cases where an employer does not participate in the federal old age survivors. And that's why the employer-employee relationship becomes important in the analysis, is because of the specific language used within the statute.
Before you run out of time, could you address whether the average weekly wage was raised and addressed at the hearing or not?
Yes, Your Honor, I will. If I would point back to the folio site of pages 1108, commencing at that page and going forward. The issue of the average weekly wage was very specifically argued in the offset section of the position statement that was provided to the judge at hearing. And the average weekly wage and the fact of consideration of the total income having to be considered at that level was considered in that. And that extends on for a few pages there for analysis of the judge before the order was entered. The judge talked about, or Ms. Keck talked about, the fact that there was a huge part of the determination that was made by the judge based on Mr. Zerba's age. That was absolutely a considered factor. It was stated to be a considered factor by the judge. However, I think a huge factor that can't be ignored here really is the fact that he had 1,000 pounds dropped on his chest at work. And 1,000 pounds results in compression fractures to the chest of any individual based on any age, and certainly the disability that results from that is something to be considered when you consider the injury. But for this injury, for all indications, Mr. Zerba would have continued to work. He was working before. He was a hardworking Marine, and he had been a hardworking Marine for 28 years, and then he remade himself into another line of work. There's no reason to believe that but for this accident he wouldn't have continued to work on that in that arena. Permanent total disability is something that that the judge considers human factors that go into that, and certainly a human factor is age. The disability that results from military service is something that was considered in the case that the city and county case. However, that was not the only deciding factor in that case. And that's something that needs to be considered here in conjunction with the average weekly wage. There is, as a practitioner, one avenue for all of the factors that are being analyzed here to remain constitutional as applied, and that is for the administrative law judge to review and consider the average weekly wage and inclusion of the average weekly wage calculations as argued by the claimant down there. There's insufficient evidence in the record to pull out what portion of the military pay that he's receiving is disability versus retirement, because that information simply doesn't exist in the record. If there's going to be an analysis there, it's got to go back on remands for more sufficient evidence to be put back into the record on that analysis. Same is true with the average weekly wage. If we're going to hold clear the Culver case, we're going to hold clear the Romero decision, and we're going to hold clear the analysis of average weekly wage that's done in the Avalanche case and portions of that case, by the way, I need to clarify here, have been overturned by the Supreme Court itself in the Benchmark versus Simpson case. But in order for all of those pieces to fit squarely together in this case, and for everything to remain constitutional, the analysis of the average weekly wage must be done by the administrative law judge. Otherwise, everything falls apart.
Thank you, Ms. Ragland. Thanks again, Ms. Keck. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes